The white supremacists in Charlottesville last weekend were not all part of one group, but a conglomeration of several. The KKK, alt-righters, white nationalists, and swastika-waving neo-Nazis. Reporter A.C. Thompson of ProPublica was there covering the chaos, and he's been tracking hate groups for ProPublica's Documenting Hate project. And A.C. joins me from California by Skype. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
And also with us is University of Maryland psychology professor Ariai Kruglansky. He studies the psychological processes behind radicalization, de-radicalization, and terrorism. Hi there, Ariai.
Good morning, Celeste.
Just a warning for listeners, some of the things we're about to discuss might not be suitable for children. Let's go to you, A.C. Thompson, especially in light of the president's press conference in which he was talking about possibly some good people that were among the neo-Nazi white supremacist group. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, well, from having been on the ground there, I'll tell you that overwhelmingly, the people who were involved in the Unite the Right protest were white supremacists of one variety or another, neo-fascists, neo-Confederates, white nationalists, etc. I saw and met nobody who wasn't a part of some sort of white supremacist movement while I was interviewing people there, and I interviewed a lot of people there. I didn't see or meet any sort of average mainstream Republicans or conservatives who just said, we really love this monument, we don't want it to go. I think the president is mistaken if he thinks that there were groups other than white supremacists that played any significant role in participating in the protest.
So, Ariai, we in the past year since 9/11, we've talked a lot about how young Muslims especially become radicalized. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about how white men become radicalized. And it appears from the statistics that that's actually the group that's the largest danger to Americans. Why is this not a point of discussion?
I think it's because the Muslim threat has been amplified by the media. It's been all over the news, and it's the media that have really not paid enough attention to this growing threat. Not only in this country, but also in Europe, the proportion of attacks by white supremacists, neo-Nazis, fascists, and so forth exceeds by far that by Muslims. So it's a hidden danger, as great a danger as that of Islamic extremism that has been under the radar for a long while.
So I want to play you, AC, this comment from Robert Ray. He is actually a contributor to the neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer.
Mm-hmm.
He's speaking to Vice News in this comment, talking about how the internet has actually made it easier for him and his organization.
For instance, last night at the Torch Walk, there were hundreds and hundreds of us. People realize they're not atomized individuals. They're part of a larger whole because we have been spreading our memes. We have been organizing on the internet. And so now they're coming out. And now, as you can see today, we greatly outnumbered the anti-white, anti-American filth.
How would you say the internet has contributed to organization of protests and also of these hate groups?
You know, I think his point is absolutely important to note. The internet is really the propulsive mechanism behind the new white supremacist movement. Absolutely. These folks are meeting each other on the internet. Like the Daily Stormer, for example, had a forum, they called it their book club, where you could network with other local neo-Nazis and meet up in real life and go shoot guns. People posted pictures of themselves doing that or do whatever. And so a lot of the people that ended up in Charlottesville organized on this forum and then grouped up to come together to the event. The internet is a place where neo-Nazi groups, white supremacist groups have leveraged social media and have used social media in incredibly effective ways to make new recruits, to make new converts, and to network.
So this is really very similar to the way that ISIS supporters have been mobilized. And I think that from a psychological perspective, it's a very important point because due to the fact that violence is generally shunned in civilized society, you need a support group that legitimizes it. And the internet provides that. The network that the internet creates provides validation and vindication of violence as a means of attaining political religious goals. And this also relates to the great weight that is given to the president's seeming approval, seeming support for these activities that surfaced in the last 2 days. That, again, you know, a major figure, the president of the United States, is condoning, in some sense, these behaviors. That is a tremendous sense of validation of behaviors that the general society, the mainstream, shuns and condemns.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Arieh Kuglansky, whose voice you just heard, University of Maryland psychology professor and ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, who specializes in reporting on extremist groups. I want to play for you both two comments from Christopher Cantwell. He is with the Unite the Right movement, and he spoke with Vice News over the weekend in Charlottesville. And again, a warning for our listeners, this is upsetting. These are upsetting comments. Take a listen.
When the Trayvon Martin case happened, you know, Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and all these different things happened, every single case, it's some little black behaving like a savage, and he gets himself in trouble, shockingly enough. Whatever problems I might have with my fellow white people, they generally are not inclined to such behavior.
And here's the second one where he says, in fact, although he supports Donald Trump, he is not the ideal.
I'm here to spread ideas, talk, in the hopes that somebody more capable will come along and do that. Somebody like Donald Trump, who does not give his daughter to a Jew.
So Donald Trump, but like more racist.
Yeah, a lot more racist than Donald Trump.
AC, there has been a number of, again, I want to go back to the president's comments just because they're echoed now among many conservatives, that we're talking about, especially with somebody like Cantwell, is a tiny, tiny minority, and that for the most part, they're talking about the problem for many of these groups is that they feel they have been left behind or that they have legitimate complaints. How do you view those claims?
Meaning that the president's saying there was a tiny minority of white supremacist groups at the rally?
No, these extremists, like the comments that we just heard, are the exception.
You know, I mean, here's the thing. The thing is that the Trump era, the Trump message, has helped to galvanize and catalyze an entire new generation of white supremacists. And he is, in many ways, a key component to this combustible mixture that we have now. And what I would say is, yes, many of these people, like Chris Cantwell, who advocates throwing people out of helicopters, have moved beyond Trump. And when you interview people on the ground in Charlottesville and at other white supremacist rallies, they'll say, Trump, yeah, he's not our perfect guy, but he opened the door to this new racial consciousness. And he was the first white politician in decades to speak openly about race. And they take great solace in his messaging. They know that his refusal to immediately disavow them, that was a signal to them. That was a signal saying, hey, you know, basically I'm on your side. This is the wink. And they are looking for the subtle signals. They know eventually he has to disavow David Duke or the white supremacist movement or whatever, but they follow his Twitter intently. They follow his messaging intently, and they feel like they are constantly getting signs of support, subtle signs of support. And the truth is, they are right about that.
Well, Arieh, let me ask you, because we got responses that the young man who has been is now accused of committing murder with his car. And also there was another family that came out and absolutely disavowed their son who marched with the white supremacists. Those families expressed surprise. They said, I don't know where he learned those views. I don't know. This is a shock to us. How does a family know? How does this begin?
Again, you know, it's very similar and echoes the process that happens with Muslim extremists. The families very often are surprised because it's surreptitious. It's carried out with chat rooms and the social media without the knowledge of the family. If the young person knows that the family is against it, he's going to conceal it. But I wanted to also add another dimension, and that is that however important Trump's endorsement of this movement is, he is not the sole source of the problem. The problem has been global. In this country and around the world, there has been a rise in extremism, in fascism, in neo-Nazism. That has been the case in Europe, and it has received legitimation from political parties to the right. So there is a kind of continuity, and the same thing has been happening in this country before Trump. So there are general global reasons, such as the uncertainty, the economic uncertainty, the turmoil produced by waves of immigration, by refugees, the sense of some people, some young people, that their sense of future, their prospect, their sense of respect and significance are endangered. And that opens the psychological space for extremist ideologies of the kind that these movements are endorsing.
That is Ariai Kuglansky. He's a University of Maryland professor. We also have ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson with us. Just ahead, we continue this conversation. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about the new generation of white supremacists who surfaced at this weekend's rally in Charlottesville. My guests are ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson, who joins us by Skype, and also on the line is University of Maryland psychology professor Ariai Kuglansky. And again, a note, some of the things we are discussing may be unsuitable for children. Let me play you another comment here, and this is actually Licia Brooks. She's the outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and she's talking to NPR about the fact that people of color often have conversations with children about what it means to be a person of color in America, and those conversations don't happen with white kids. So take a listen.
White families need to have conversations with their children, with their grandchildren, with their nieces and their nephews about what it means to be white in America. These young white men are vulnerable to the messages from white supremacy who would tell them that multiculturalism or an emphasis on diversity and inclusion means that they're going to be excluded.
So, AC, we've talked a little bit about once they get to some of these websites and things, how they then become swayed by these arguments. But what leads them to those websites? How do they even begin?
You know, I think Professor Kuglansky's points earlier were worth noting. You know, I think there is a general unease about terrorism, and that is blamed in this country largely on folks from outside the country or towards immigrants and people of color, people of religious minorities. So that's one sort of factor that is radicalizing people. There is the truth that demographics are changing in America. And I think there's a sense from a lot of young white men that they will be a minority, and they have seen how other minorities are treated in this country, and they don't like that prospect. I think a third thing that was brought up is economics. And I think there's a unease about where the economy is going and where the future lies for working people in this country. And instead of sort of thinking about what is a way to create a better, more equitable, more just economy, the notion is, hey, there's people to blame for our economic problems. Let's get them out of the country. And I think there's real factors like that. I'll also say, you know, the online video gaming culture in this country is really rife with racism. And so there are millions of people playing online video games every day, every night, and they're communicating with each other through various messaging.
And sexism and misogyny, I should say.
Yeah, and sexism and misogyny. Thank you. Through various messaging systems. And there is all kinds of crazy discourse going on on those platforms that is racist, homophobic, sexist, xenophobic. And I think that's another gateway.
So, Professor Kuglansky, maybe play you this comment from former FBI agent Michael German. He's speaking with NPR here about the fact that many white supremacists are not actually violent.
There are millions of racists in the United States. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are with organized white supremacist groups. Very few actually commit acts of violence. There are also people who are not part of the white supremacist movement or any ideological movement who commit mass atrocities. So we have to understand that the ideology, it's neither necessary or sufficient to the violence that we're trying to control.
So REI, it sounds like he's saying that just because you're a white supremacist doesn't mean you're a danger. Is there something of concern just in being a white supremacist?
Yes, definitely. I think there is a continuity between political views and the use of extreme means such as violence to advance those views. There is a continuity between the political right that is legitimized around the world in various parties that try to govern those states, and the kind of less legal means of advancing similar ideas through violence and through mayhem. So it is true that rather few those who participate in right-wing extremist movement actually commit violence, but many of them endorse violence committed by others. Now, from the psychological perspective, to actually engage in acts of violence requires a degree of commitment that very few would have. Because this degree of commitment means foregoing all else, endangering one's life, one's career, one's future for the cause. And very few people are willing to do that. So they may endorse the views, endorse the activities of others, while themselves going pretty much about their business. But there are moments in time where the emotions prevail, for example, when symbolic issues such as statues of historical significance or music or a kind of circumstance where people are drunk and emotionally aroused, that they can commit to violence. So I think, you know, the fact that the ideology endorses violence and allows it can slide into violence under specific circumstances where people are willing to commit all for the cause.
All right. So, AC, this is your area. Extremism is your area of expertise. That's what you report on. It means you're going into danger, frankly, over the course of your job. I want to play you this comment again from Licia Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And she's talking about the fact that this whole issue is something the U.S. is just not grappling with.
It's important for people to speak out and recognize things for what they are. Recognize that there's a tremendous rise in white supremacy, in violent domestic terrorism. We are on the brink of violence in this country due to the rise in extremism from the far right.
Is there a way, and I'm going to ask you as well, Professor, but AC, do you think there is a way at this point that we can prevent this, as a nation, that we can prevent this?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? I think a key thing is going to be leadership from the top, and we're not seeing that. And so in the absence of that, I think what we're going to see, and what may be hopeful and maybe something of a remedy, is action from the bottom, is people in the streets, people in the communities, people at the local level, saying this is not what we're about. This is not what America is about to us.
I want to echo that very strongly, because the United States is among the few nations that are not doing anything about it. There is a very strong tradition of counter-violent extremist program in European nations that has gathered a lot of experience of how to do it. Germany has a 10-year CVE program, very well developed, and there is a lot of experience there. Denmark has the Aarhus model that is very promising. The UK has the PREVENT program. And as AC pointed out, it has to happen on the local level, from the ground up. It cannot be imposed by the government. There is an organization of strong cities. I just recently participated in their meeting in Denmark. Some American cities are members of that network, and these cities organize the societal institutions, the social services, the educational institutions, the religious institutions, in order to combat and prevent extremism. Yeah. This is the address that families whose children are showing signs of extremism can turn to. Police is involved.
Yeah.
So it is a whole community effort to counter this dangerous, pernicious wave, and we do not see hardly any of that in our country, and that
yeah.
needs to happen.
That is a University of Maryland professor Ari Kuglansky and also ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.